School jobs. My own first job was similar to many, a paper round. I guess I was around 14, and I'd heard from friends that having a paper round gave you the opportunity to supplement your pocket money and was something that only took half an hour or so in the morning or evening and would earn you at least twice as much as your weekly pocket money, and maybe more. At the time, my demands on my finances were mostly made by my hobbies, mainly fishing, photography, buying records and scouts, and it was the last of these that probably tipped the balance in favour of employment. I didn't mind getting up early, and my hobby of fishing had probably contributed to this, as at weekends I met friends early on a Saturday to go fishing. There was a theory, not substantially proven to my mind, that fish were more likely to be caught in the early morning. The same theory also suggested dusk was a good time, leading us to sometimes arrive home late for our evening meal after having one last cast for the big one. No, it was scouts that were placing a demand on my finances, as the annual summer camps had increasingly got more ambitious, graduated from campsites in Mid Wales to a trip the previous year to Southern Ireland in County Cork, and my first holiday outside England and Wales. The following summer, the camp was even more ambitious, a mainland European trip on the continent. We were to travel in our own coach to Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany and Holland over a fortnight. My parents offered to pay for the trip, but we agreed that I would have to supply my own spending money. And not being a great saver, it was clear that I needed to raise money over and above my pocket money. So the paper round it was. I think it was a learning experience, waking to an alarm clock and going out before school, whatever the weather. Also hearing the newsagent grumbling when other paper boys didn't turn up, and learning an early lesson about the benefits of being reliable. I didn't mind it when the mornings were bright and dry, but the wet mornings were less appealing. Nevertheless, I raised the spending money for the camp, which I guess my parents probably added to. The camp was a great success, and quite different from our normal camps. The simpler and more rustic pleasures of these are covered in my earlier book, A 1950s Boy. It was more of a European sightseeing tour, mostly using city campsites with better facilities such as shower blocks and on-site shops and cafes, not the rustic camps we'd previously experienced. There was the revelation that beer and lager could be bought by 14-year-olds, which we discovered the first night in a Belgian campsite bar. This certainly enlivened the games of table football and table tennis. Further juvenile amusement was derived from the labelling of the drink as pills, and apparently pronounced as piss. Simple pleasures. There was also the learning curve of the strength of some of these lagers, when one of the smaller boys had to be actually carried back to the tent after overindulgence. I suspect the consumption was more closely monitored after this, as the scout leader, known to us as Bosun, was the father of Bruce, one of my school friends, and he generally took his responsibilities, as in loco parentis, very seriously. I don't recall any recurrences of overindulgence, although the reaction the next day of the hungover one to a fried breakfast may have proved a deterrent to others. Not all my hard-earned money was spent on pills, as there were other temptations, such as sheath knives and lighters in the shape of guns. Gifts were bought to take home, and I recall a miniature cuckoo clock bought in Luxembourg and a table lamp in the shape of a sailing ship from Amsterdam. We were at that age, immune to accusations of cliché or issues of poor taste. Flag pennants were also popular to confirm that we were now international travellers. Highlights of the visit were boat trips on the Amsterdam canals, viewing Brussels from the Etonium, a futuristic shiny building comprising a number of huge connected chromium balls joined by escalators. It stood over 300 feet high and was built for the 1958 World Fair and was the most eccentric building I'd ever seen. We were also in Koblenz for a festival called the Rhine in Flames, which had a procession of lit up barges sailing down the river alongside the city campsite and culminating in a firework display, which is more spectacular than any firework displays at the time at home. I vaguely recall some amateurish attempts to chat up local girls at a fun fair, but the fact that we had to wear our scout uniforms, including shorts, when off-site seemed to contradict the cliché that that all the girls love a man in uniform. Maybe it doesn't apply to 15-year-old scouts and German schoolgirls. My attempts at photography were limited to one 35mm slide film and only seemed to have a small number of those that survived. This has seemed strange today when we all have the ability to record thousands of digital images with our phones. Also, I seem to have recorded images that were novel for me rather than recording my fellow scouts, which is a pity. The weather was much warmer on the continent than at home that summer, and the idyll was only marred by one event, England winning the World Cup. One tradition of travelling abroad was that Union Jack flag badges were sewn onto our scout uniforms and rucksacks. As well as pre-arranged football matches with Dutch and German scout troops, which I'm pretty sure we lost most of, there are also ad hoc campsite kickabouts, where continental cousins were anxious to prove that the England Cup final victory, if not a home team fix, was a fluke and not to be repeated. In fact, history seems to have borne this out. But I do reflect that a better tactic would have been to establish with them that at the outset we were from Wales, and at that time, before the Gareth Bale era, the nation was not a serious world soccer contender. I've since learned that Wales had previously qualified for the World Cup in 1958, so my contention may be open to dispute. On the other hand, it may have been the newly enjoyed supplies of pills and chips with mayonnaise that was our undoing. The next term, back at school after the summer holidays, studies were to begin in earnest for our GCSE O-level courses. I think my parents recommended I concentrate on my schoolwork, perhaps worrying that my early rising for the paper round would sap my youthful energies. So I was to temporarily leave the newly entered world of work to concentrate on my academic education. At school, I didn't really think too much about a future career, and for those of us who stayed on after 16, which was the age it was possible to leave school at that time, the emphasis was to gain good A-level grades and get into university. My school was a traditional red brick boys' grammar school that clearly thought well of itself. Every autumn term, the head would proudly list the name of pupils who'd left the previous term and been accepted into Oxford and Cambridge, followed by a reasonably lengthy list of ex-sixth formers entering other universities, although they were not deemed as worthy of naming. I later discovered that a number of senior staff, as well as having distinguished themselves in wartime service, were also themselves graduates of Oxbridge. Given this, it may have been disrespectful for us to use the traditional humorous nicknames that had been attached to them, for example, Monkey and Dumbo for prominent or hairy ears, Hairy for a prematurely bald master, Buzzer for another with a speech impediment that may have been a vibrato caused by poorly fitting false teeth. So it wasn't surprising that we were encouraged to set our horizons at what some may conclude an unrealistically high level. This had been set early when we were asked to select our option subjects to take for our O-levels. We were told that certain universities, and certainly Oxbridge colleges, insisted on their prospective entrants having, in addition to the obligatory English and maths, at least one foreign language, and Latin as well as one science subject, even if they were prospective art students. In the pre-Google days, the validity of these claims were impossible to check out. As a result of this, I spent 2 years struggling with French and physics before actually obtaining unspectacular, but at least pass grades in both. I had chosen physics as chemistry seemed confusing, and I was too squeamish for the dissection of animals in biology, despite having been an enthusiastic fisherman. Latin was a dead end for me, and I failed the O-level after 2 years of conjugating and declining and translating the Iliad and Caesar's Gallic Wars. Although at the time I strongly resented having to study it, in later years I admit to finding it useful to understand the derivation and meanings of many English words. So there is a lesson that there are some experiences that only have value sometime later. Still, I'm not sure my rudimentary physics knowledge has ever proved useful at all to me. At some point, we were offered career advice, as well as trying to select university subjects for study, and there was some superficial attempt to career counsel by an external careers advisor. I'd already decided that I wanted to go to university, encouraged by tales from friends, elder brothers, of the fine life they were living away from home. Along with other friends, I'd already been put off alternatives of getting a job and starting a career straight away, after a conversation, possibly at youth club, with an old friend who'd already become an article clerk at a firm of accountants locally. He described the work as boring, the pay derisory, and the hours long, to even include Saturday mornings. I don't recall the advisor using any sophisticated techniques such as psychometric tests or questionnaires. It just seemed a bit of a rambling chat. The chemistry wasn't great. After I'd mentioned the A-level subjects I was taking, my having expressed a preference to study economics at university, he started to quiz me about what career this would lead to, which of course I had no idea. I began to become defensive and suggested that this was some way off. He then became, to my mind, somewhat aggressive, which did little to help the dialogue, so I probably clammed up. He went on to explore career options should I become unsuccessful in getting to university. Anxious to bring the uncomfortable conversation to an end as soon as possible, I rejected all the possibilities he offered. In frustration, he finally proposed that being a career advisor was a good career. I'd lost all respect for him and the process by this point and suggested we were wasting each other's time, so I would now leave, which I did. I was later taken to one side by my form master, who expressed surprise that I'd been so confrontational and thought it out of character, having generally been seen as an amiable form member, having co-edited a form-year newspaper and recently been made a prefect. When I told him of the conclusion that I could become a career advisor, he had trouble suppressing his laughter, and we concluded that maybe I had a point in describing it as a waste of time. Happily, I did get a university place and was thus able to delay a career selection for another few years. Again, I don't remember much direction being given over which universities to apply to. The school library was supplied with a stock of current university prospectuses. I can't recall any weekend trips to campuses, either by myself or any of my friends. When I arrived, there were many fellow students that admitted this was their first visit, and they'd applied blind as such, some on the basis that one of their parents had studied there some decades before. Maybe a lot of life was more random at that time. Certainly we didn't have the information overload of today.